Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Dr. T. Colin Campbell has spent more than 40 years researching the link between diet and diseases. His best-known work, The China Study, explores the health benefits of plant-based nutrition and has sold more than 1 million copies. A professor emeritus at Cornell University, he did his undergraduate work at Penn State. Campbell has given more than 600 public lectures and has been featured in several documentary films about his research and ideas. We'll talk with him about what led him to his China study and more. Dr. Colin Campbell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You attended Penn State in their pre-veterinary medicine program, later went to Cornell University where you studied biochemistry and nutrition with the idea that you would learn something to take back to your Virginia dairy farm. In fact, you thought that you would figure out how to produce more efficiently animal protein. What happened? What changed your thinking?
That's exactly what happened. It was traditional to think that way, whether we're on the farm or whether I was in school at the time. So I did that, then left school, went to MIT to work for 3 years there as a research associate. It wasn't until I went to Virginia Tech in the Department of Biochemistry, and then working in the project that we had in the Philippines.
You were working with malnourished children, belief that what they need is more protein.
That's exactly right, and that was commonplace. I mean, everybody sort of knew that. That was, who didn't think that? There was said to be a protein gap in the world. Not enough. That was big news, even out in the public. And so, and there were a number of universities developing projects to make sure that the poor countries got enough of this protein. So when I went there, we were doing the same thing in a way. And then I heard about this very unusual case or cases where some very young children were getting liver cancer. And that was my other hat. I was interested in cancer and how it works and so forth. I was hearing that those few families consuming the most protein like we do in the West, their children are more likely to get the liver cancer. But we didn't have all the facts on liver cancer. And then there was this report from India, experimental research report with experimental animals showing the same thing. You know, animals programmed to get liver cancer fed higher levels of protein as opposed to lower. The ones with the higher levels of protein are the ones that got the cancer. It's quite dramatic, major difference.
The conventional wisdom is that protein is a superfood, that we need between 10 and 35% of our calories should be consumed in protein. You believe it should be 10% or less.
Well, just about 10%. I don't even think too much about the numbers anymore because it turns out if you eat vegetables, fruits, grains, legumes, one's going to get somewhere in the neighborhood of at least 10, 8 to 10. And actually, if you're eating a lot of legumes, you can get it up to 15, 16, 17%, which incidentally is not a problem when it's in the form of plant-based foods. It brings along with it all the antioxidants and complex carbohydrates. So when we're getting it from plants, we can get easily 8 to 10%, and it could be higher. So my point is that even 8 to 10% is plenty. That's very similar to what we have been recommending for years as the recommended dietary allowance.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about how the American diet has evolved in the last 5 or 6 decades.
Well, you know, it's even maybe a little longer than that for that evolution, going back to, let's say, a century, late 1800s. Protein was discovered in 1839 in Europe, and it was characterized as the stuff of civilization itself. And so the early researchers, mostly in Europe at that time, were just revering this special nitrogen-containing nutrient. It was needed to for dogs.
Life itself.
Yeah, for dogs to survive. It was dogs in that case. And so they got really enthused about this, and I think their enthusiasm occurred because they got the protein from the meat. They knew it was the meat. And so the thought arose that this protein was what makes meat good. And so meat and protein became almost synonymous. It wasn't until maybe 30, 40 years later that they started to realize that protein was in plants. But that didn't set too well because the people who equated protein with meat, they kind of liked the idea. They wanted to eat meat. And to say it's in plants, all of a sudden this new concept arose. The plant protein was called poor quality compared to the animal protein, high quality. So that sold well in the ensuing decades. if you wanted to get real protein, you know, good quality protein, you had to get it from animal-based foods. That was it.
And in fact, the mindset is that meat is macho and that a vegetable-based diet is wimpy and weak and really very unappealing.
Exactly. There was a comment made by the senior medical advisor for the United Kingdom Empire in India at that time, medical doctor. They were wanting to find the different tribes of India to provide soldiers for the army at the time. And I read some of this old stuff, and the medical advisor was talking about these different tribes, finding the ones that ate the most meat. So, yeah, that machoism was alive and well. And that was, I think, 1912.
Tell us a little bit about your China study. You started your research in 1974, came out with your book not until 2005. Most people who've heard of your China study associate it with Bill Clinton, who's one of the probably best known followers of the China study diet,
right,
which is a low-fat, low-meat diet. Tell us more about it. Plant-based
diet. Well, actually, our own research program started in 1965, and then from 1965 in the Philippines, on up until about 1980, it was strictly that idea of exploring effective protein on cancer in the laboratory. In 1980, that's when the United States and China first started talking to each other, and the first senior scientist from China to come to the United States came to work with me. And so his name was Dr. Chen, and Dr. Chen and I sort of spent a year together, and we learned about the China government having just produced an atlas of maps showing where
the cancer atlas, so geographically,
exactly,
where is this cancer?
Sure enough, and that occurred to me that at that time I'm kind of into the diet and cancer thing a lot, and he came to work with me in part for that reason. And so I just made a suggestion, you know, it'd be kind of interesting to go there and see why is cancer so common here and not there, kind of thing. One thing led to another. He knew the senior investigator of the cancer atlas study. They were collecting data on a total of about 800 million people, how much cancer was occurring in each different counties. So we got together and talked about doing a study. Well, I went to NIH. He went to his government. One of his government people came to speak with me. We got to know each other, talking more. I was sent by our NIH to China on a fellowship to go see what might be possible. And so we got the money. This was the first project between the United States and China in the area of research. That's how it started in 1983. And then we spent from 83 and somewhat in 84 collecting information in the field. We had a total of about 250 workers.
You know, 6,000 people were studied.
6,500 families.
That's right. In 60 different counties
in 65
rural China.
Yes, or as we also say, 130 villages, two villages per county. So we collected all this information, the most comprehensive collection of data ever for a medical project. Collected it from 1983 or 84 or so until about 1988. We were just assembling the data, cleaning it up, so to speak, and analyzing the samples. And we had about 24 laboratories around the world working. And when I say we, I need to tell you that my chief partner in many ways is Sir Richard Peto. Richard Peto at the University of Oxford. So I went to Oxford, had a position there too. And Richard and I and others at Oxford and the ones in China, we all get together assembling all this information. Finally, we sort of had it in a tabulated form along about 1989, 1990. And then it was jointly published as a big book, about 900 pages with all the data. It was jointly published by Cornell University Press, the Oxford University Press, and the China People's Publishing House, as they said. So it was a joint publication between our three countries. That was in 1990. Then it caught the attention of a lot of media people in this country, including the New York Times, the USA Today, Saturday Evening Post. They all ran cover stories on this. Then it got a lot of attention. But
not all of it good. You said that there's
enormous
hostility and antagonism for promoting the ideas that came from that. In some respects, you've been hounded for your views.
Well, that's true. I mean, I don't say it as necessarily as a personal kind of thing. I'm just sort of just describing, you know, the scenery, if you will. And it turned out that the New York Times actually said something that was pretty provocative for us as science. They called it the Grand Prix of all studies, you know, really kind of praising it and all this kind of thing, a little bit going overboard. And I was not sure I liked that description. And so I called up the reporter from the Times and even asked her, I said, why did you put that title in there? Why, you know, I said, that's stretching it a little bit. And she said, I didn't do it. She said, the editors did it. Same thing happened with the USA Today. They were anxious to describe this in glowing terms.
Why do you suppose they were so anxious about what you were saying? And well, what you were saying was, we need less protein and that protein is implicated in cancer.
There are two reasons. One is, at that time, keep in mind, the United States and China are just really starting to work out some relationships and things like that. Our relationship was probably one of the most successful. It was written up. In fact, I was invited on one occasion about that time to come to a joint meeting of senior Chinese, United Nations, and American leaders to describe why was I so successful in China compared to other people who were trying to get projects started. So it was getting that reputation, and that was partly it. But then they wrote the thing up as pretty grandiose. And they say I kind of reacted negatively because I thought that's putting me in a little bit of difficulty in my supposedly very objective field of science. I came home to my wife and I said to her, You know, what am I going to do? Am I going to say, hey, that's going too far? And when I looked at it, they did a good job writing it up. It was all true.
Well, tell us the basics of your findings.
In rural China, where our study was, basically, their diets were really low in fat. The average fat content was only 14.5%, whereas ours was like 35. I mean, low in fat, high in dietary fiber, high in plant material. I mean, there was a range there for different counties, but very low. So it was the kind of situation where I wasn't sure that we'd see anything. I thought perhaps all these people are eating plant-based diets, but we saw within that range the same trends like higher cholesterol consumption or higher cholesterol in the blood or higher animal protein consumption and so forth. We're starting to see these trends that going from a very low level, almost no animal foods, to only a modest level, the diseases started to appear. That was pretty provocative, too. That was consistent with what I had been seeing in the laboratory.
You were focusing on a particular protein, casein, which is very high in cow's milk. Tell us a little bit about what you found there and what you concluded.
Well, the casein studies were done in our experimental animals in the 70s, late 60s, 70s, and on the 80s. And I was just using that as a means to disturb the cancer process, so to speak, so I could understand the cancer process. But it was almost like the tail wagging the dog, because we're using a protein to do what I'm really interested in, but all of a sudden realized this protein thing, if you will. I realized that we're using casein. Well, that's pretty provocative. And what about some other proteins? So we looked at a couple more plant-based proteins, and they didn't do it. I mean, all of a sudden the light bulb's coming on in many different directions. And I'm saying, you know, this whole question concerning food as it relates to cancer and possibly heart disease, it's pretty much focused on animal food as being the difficult part of it.
Speaking of sorting it out, how do you respond to critics who have said that you've cherry-picked your information because you had a preset opinion and you chose the data to support it?
Okay, my preset position was to show that eating a high-protein, high-fat diet was the best thing we could do.
Interesting.
That was my bias. And, you know, I started looking at it, and the data didn't show that. So if I cherry-picked, I was cherry-picking the wrong stuff, you know, for my own bias. So that, I have to say, is pure nonsense.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia, and our guest is Dr. T. Colin Campbell. He's co-author of the China Study. He's also one of the world's leading proponents of a plant-based diet. If a poor diet leads to disease, could a good diet reverse disease? And Americans have a very difficult time swallowing that.
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, as was described by some of the early researchers in the early 1900s, for example, when they were talking about higher protein consumption, animal-based food, they called it the stuff of civilization itself. And so you can see in the old history, the literature, this emerging idea that animals are there for us to eat. And milk is there for us to drink because it has these wonderful properties. But those ideas were culturally embedded and philosophically oriented, I think, and for various and sundry reasons, and it really caught hold. And then the industry started forming around that too. You know, the livestock industry, the dairy industry, and so forth and so on. So it just continued to grow in and of itself.
Have you gotten much pushback from those industries?
Oh, yes.
Because of your message?
Of course. The dairy industry, of which I was a part, my first publication actually was in the Journal of Animal Science. and my first offer of a position actually was here at Penn State for a faculty position. I was offered a position when I was quite young as a professor of dairy science. I turned it down, but I was very much in that camp. And in any case, as our research unfolded, I'm seeing something different. You know, there's something else here that's a little more exciting. And now I've become quite fascinated with the whole history of this field, all the way back to Socrates and Plato and Pythagoras. You know, they said at that time, Plato has it in his dialogues, that, you know, people who basically eat that way get a disease that he described as looking like cancer.
And of course, Socrates said, eat to live, not live to eat.
Yes, and Hippocrates also said, let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food. You know, it's really interesting. The ancient Greeks, insofar as their science was concerned, they were making observations that turned out these days to be quite true. And they also said, too, there's stuff in that old literature to say that the Olympians of their day, that's the athletes, knew to eat this kind of food that was better for them. And we've wrestled with that ever since the last 2,000 years.
Today, elite athletes may eat as much as 40% of their calories in protein. The Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine would like to change that. And so they have enlisted high-performing athletes who are now eating a whole foods, plant-based diet.
Right.
Do athletes need more protein than the average person?
I don't think they do. I guess we can still debate that question a little bit. When I was working with Tony Gonzalez, for example, the football player, and a couple of other individuals on this question, they were asking me, well, how much protein should I really have? I couldn't answer with any very definitively at that point, at least extra protein to do what they wanted to do, that is, achieve their athletic.
Build muscle.
Yeah, build muscle, run faster, whatever. As we started thinking about it, and the more looking at it and watching some of the athletes, what happened to them when they changed, I said, wait, this is ridiculous. They don't need that protein. And in fact, then I was learning too that from two sources, familiar with the facts, that the athletes who had the most extra protein, they die at a remarkably young age. They gain a lot of weight, they get a lot of muscle and all that kind of thing, but then they get diabetes and they get cancer and they get obesity and heart disease and so forth. And so that's not generally known. Even today, that's not known to them.
Tell us a little bit about the evolution of your own diet. How do you eat? And I ask that because you talk about the importance of a spare yet nutritious diet. So when we look at cancer, it's not just fat and sugar and all of those things, but also how many calories we're consuming.
Yes, if we eat too many calories, that's too much food. I should say, usually that's the wrong kind of food. We're doing two things. Increasing quantity, not expending it, and eating the wrong kind of food, that can lead to problems very clearly. So it leads to this idea, calories in is a bad problem, and it is to some extent. But in reality, in our experiments, we found that after 25 years, doing this many, many times, in the animals that got the least cancer consumed the most calories. Not very much more, but it's significant. They consume the most calories. And so we actually researched that question quite a bit to find out what happens to these calories. How can they get away with eating all these extra calories? And it has to do with the fact that those calories being consumed on a plant-based diet, a larger proportion of it is expended as body heat and or voluntary or involuntary physical activity. So it tends to make us feel better. We get more energetic. It starts to make sense. And so what we saw in the animals that I also saw in the Chinese population.
You like to use the term whole foods, plant-based diet.
Right.
As opposed to vegetarian or vegan, which of course is a stricter form of vegetarianism. Why that term and what exactly does it mean? What do you consider a whole plant-based food?
First off, I very much appreciate the fact that the vegetarians and vegans, you know, as communities kind of support our work and are advancing the cause and they're in a sense doing the right thing in many ways. They arrived at their opinions mostly for ideological reasonings, as we all know. And that's not sufficient to convince a lot of people, you know, of that practice. But the problem is that vegetarians, 90% of those people still use dairy. So the nutrient composition of their diets is not that different from the non-vegetarians. And it's the nutrient composition that really matters. You know, amount of fat, amount of protein, and so forth. Vegetarians are substituting milk for meat in large measure, maybe eggs too. Vegans, they're avoiding all animal foods, we all know that, but they don't consciously think too much about the science, and so they end up eating processed foods and
the vegan junk food junkie.
Exactly. Too often. Just a recent study of the larger study on vegans showed that the average fat content in the diet is 30%. The diets are not very good. And we see some health advantages, of course, for vegans and vegetarians, but it's not what it could be if they really follow the science.
So explain for us, what do you mean then by whole foods? What ones are you recommending, and especially which ones are high in protein?
Well, we say vegetables, fruits, grains, legumes, maybe some nuts, of course, too, in a whole food form. And what I'm saying about that is that we can grind them up if we want to or whatever we do with them. We can cook them to some extent. That's not a big deal. It's just the fact of keeping the whole thing intact. Instead of, for example, in the case of grains, we refine them. We take the hull away. We're taking the best part away and feeding it to pigs. We've been doing it for years. And we just tend to do that. We throw the peels of vegetables and so forth away. And it's really the whole intact food, best served fresh, obviously, as much as possible. It doesn't have to be raw, but we do that naturally. You know, we eat fruits pretty much raw. And when I'm talking about the whole food, I know the term is it doesn't just flow off the tongue very easily. And I'm the one that devised that term because I was very conscious of the fact that my scientific colleagues were perturbed by those words, vegan and vegetarian, and they weren't doing the right thing anyhow, so I was looking for something more to run inside.
How optimistic are you that the diet you're promoting will pick up steam? And I ask that because here we are in 2015, and 5% of the American public eats a vegetarian diet, 2.5% or so what we would call a vegan diet. Perhaps they'll start calling it a whole foods if they clean it up a little bit. But how optimistic are you that this will take hold?
Well, I have given at least more than 600 lectures since our book came out. And that book itself has sold 1.5 million copies. That's a China study, for starters. And a lot of celebrities and other people have sort of picked up on it. But in my lectures, in the last 4 or 5 years, I'd say, the majority of my lectures now have to been to medical schools. That is very exciting. I just came from Los Angeles 2 weeks ago, speaking to an audience of 600, 95% of them were primary care doctors. Then I went to Spain right after that. That was a medical association. There were national medical meetings. And then Slovakia, Italy. In Italy, there were a lot of doctors.
Thrilled that there's interest in the medical.
It's from the medical community.
That
is very
exciting.
So when that happens, and that's just coming from doctors who really care and they just search out the information, if they were all just taught this, that's the key. And so I'm trying to make a proposal to them now that we have a program, actually an online program, that we can actually do that. I can say, just give me your medical students 3 weeks. I will change their attitude for the rest of their careers.
Food is medicine.
That's right.
How much nutrition education does the average medical student in the U.S. get today?
Well, there's been some studies on that, and they've indicated that for the last 30 years, it's still the same. It's at best, I think there's a couple of schools might get 15 to 20 hours worth of lecture at best. But it's a description of nutrition of the wrong kind. They'll talk about individual nutrients that lead to maybe nutrient supplementation. So they certainly don't talk about this kind of thing. I don't know what the figures are, but I think latest I've heard 60 to 70% of medical students don't get any lectures.
You mentioned supplements. Yes, where do supplements fit into all of this?
Well, supplements arguably are obviously the nutrients that matter. So we put antioxidants in them like beta carotene and vitamin C and vitamin E and stuff like that. It sounds like a good idea. It did. But now we're finding, after many, many studies in the last 25, 30 years, that when people do that and then we're able to follow them to see how they do, they're not working. These nutrient supplements are simply not working. And a lot of these studies are indicating that when people take these nutrients that way, they actually experience worse effects. So that begs the question, why so? Well, from my perspective, those nutrients are being consumed out of context, out of their natural context. Any single nutrient consumed out of its natural context can be expected.
Well, some will even say that about casein, which you implicate with. So if you look at it in isolation, maybe in combination with whole milk, it isn't the dangerous carcinogen that you think it is.
Yes, we did. We did exactly what you said. We looked at things in isolation, one thing at a time and things like that. That's the way we do research. What that teaches us, our properties. It teaches us something about what these chemicals are capable of doing. and how they interact with the system. It's very useful information. What I did, though, instead of just relying on just that information on one thing at a time and then talking about it in that context, I was interested in looking at all this information, bring it together to see if we could begin to draw a larger picture. So that was a very exciting idea, because when you do it that way, then you see these remarkable results.
You know, thinking about your research, you used a term in your talk at Penn State. You referred to the field of nutrition science as ghost science because of outside interests influencing what nutritionists study.
Yeah, I did that, and I do that intentionally because I've been in academia all my life, but I've discovered in recent years that now, especially when I start talking about this unusual idea, a lot of kickback. And this kickback is coming from academic authorities. Makes me wonder, what's academia for? You know, I've been receiving a lot of pressure to stop talking that way. Now, they've actually, a couple of cases, blocked a publication.
To stop talking that way, do you mean like stop saying don't drink milk?
Yes. That's a lightning rod of major proportions. Or just talking about eating plants, because that's not, we're talking about this holistic idea. That's another sort of hot button issue.
There are some who say that the federal government is implicated and the food guide pyramid is implicated in American obesity. And I'm wondering what you would say to that.
Well, the dietary guidelines that gave rise to that, that started in 1980, written by two friends of mine in an office next to me. So I followed that very closely. And I've been on those kind of committees. And I've watched over the years, that has become nothing more than a tool of industry.
It's no longer a pyramid, by the way. It's a plate.
Before it was a square, and then they spent $1 million to see if they should make a circle. And then that was back in the early 90s. And then later they said, okay, let's do a pyramid. Now it's coming back to a plate. They play these games, but it's useless. Recently, the dietary guidelines that came out this time, it was the eighth one since 1980, and this was in February. It was announced what the panel had decided to do. And they were talking about plant-based things of all things. They were talking a little bit about environmental issues related to food. Kind of an interesting idea. I looked at that, but the rest of the report was very poor science. I could see the discussion.
The influence of lobbyists?
Yeah, I could see it. And I wrote a comment on that, published in the magazine called The Congressional Blog. It's called The Hill, The Congressional Blog. My reaction was, let's just do away with that committee altogether. I know what they're doing, because they're controlled by the USDA. The Department of Agriculture is the livestock-oriented agency in the U.S. government. They're the ones running the dietary guidelines that tell us what to eat. If that isn't a conflict of interest, I don't know what is.
Interesting. I want to ask you this last question, because I've interviewed Temple Grandin, who is an animal welfare advocate. She changes the way animals are slaughtered in this country. And she says she has tried but cannot function without the protein from meat. So I'm wondering, as you talk about this, whether you think it's one diet for everyone or if it should be tailored for individuals with different needs.
From time to time, yes, people do say, I can't do it, I tried it, I can't do it. And if one looks a little bit harder at that, some of these people who are saying that are really working for the industry. I'm sure in her case, I don't want to say it about any particular individual, but certainly that's true. The other thing is, they don't want to do it. And so when they try to do what they should be doing, they do it sort of halfway, or can do it a little while, they don't feel so good. Well, that can happen with some people, because all of a sudden this new food doesn't have all these addictive flavors that they're so addicted to.
The fat, the salt, the sugar.
Yeah, and so they get annoyed, and I can't do that. And so, and when your head is not into it, for starters, I don't think your body's going to respond very well either.
And on that note, unfortunately, we are out of time. Dr. Colin Campbell, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That was Dr. T. Colin Campbell, a professor emeritus at Cornell University and one of the leading advocates of a plant-based diet. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.